This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi.
All this week, I am talking with Dr. Catherine Ramsland. Dr. Catherine Ramsland, as you may know if you're a follower of true crime, wrote the book on Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, his autobiography, in fact. She spent many years communicating back and forth with Dennis, gaining an insight unlike anyone else into the mind of one of the most notorious serial killers alive today. This week, we're going in to her mind to learn about the experiences that she had while working with Dennis Rader at that time and all the way up to today, trying to better understand the mind of a killer. Join me all this week for parts 1 through 5 of my conversation with Dr. Catherine Ramsland right here on the podcast. He obviously continued on with more crimes. How did he gain the confidence to continue? Was it the fact that time had passed and he had not been caught and that just kind of slowly built the confidence crime by crime?
Yeah, it sure was confidence as much as compulsion.
Okay.
He didn't get caught, so that felt better. But he killed only 3 months later. It wasn't a very long time to pass. He didn't get caught. Nothing in the news suggested he had been seen, that they had a suspect or anything like that. And so then he thought, if he's more careful about the next person he's going to choose, then he minimizes his chances of being caught again. And so he scoped out a house where there was a young woman who lived alone and no dogs. So he watched her routines. So he figured out when she'd be there, when she wouldn't. And so he's a lot more careful with the second incident. But he did break into the house. He did wait for her, but she came home with her brother. So once again, he's made a pretty huge mistake.
Yeah.
And he put them in 2 different rooms, tied her up, but he struggled with the brother went to grab. He had 2 guns with them. The brother went to grab. Kevin was the brother. He went to grab one of the guns. And Rader really thought he was going to get shot and killed. In this particular house, he did shoot Kevin and shot him in the head. But Kevin, nevertheless, and thought he was dead, went back to the other room and heard Kevin run out. Kevin was able to get up and run out, even though he was shot. And so now Rader is realizing, oh, my God, we have a witness and I have very little time. But still, he stayed.
Yeah.
And he didn't shoot her. He stabbed her. Because he had read about it in a magazine, that this is how some other killer had done it. And so it was an experiment. And he didn't like it. He didn't like stabbing somebody. It was horrible from his perspective. She was still alive when the police came.
Yeah.
But he had a plan. I think this is where he had a bag of groceries that he had stashed somewhere and he could pick it up and look like he was just in the neighborhood shopping.
Yeah. Yeah.
If somebody were to stop and ask, he would look like just an innocent resident getting something from the grocery store.
In Wichita, I spent about 10 years there working at a radio station called KFDI, the big news radio station, was there right after he was sentenced. And what I learned when living in Wichita is almost everyone has some sort of a connective BTK story, whether it's themselves, their aunt, their mom, their sister, their brother. There's always somebody who has some degree of separation from what they suspect may have been an interaction with Dennis Rader. Many stories of, well, I came home and the back door was open and it was at the time of when he was striking and nothing happened. But a lot of people wonder, could have been a victim. I know he had that longer list. Did he talk about going out and scaring people or doing missions of just trying to see what the situation would be like going into people's homes, not with the intention to kill that day, but to basically do reconnaissance on a home?
Oh, he did do that. Now, I'll just say this. I get a lot of emails from people who are sure he tried to pick them up,
sure,
or he came in their house, and they described things that didn't happen, at least from he wasn't in that neighborhood, or he wasn't there that day, or he was, that was not his MO.
Sure.
You know, so I do get, because everybody wants to think that was the only person who was out there doing this, and he wasn't by any means the only person doing these kinds of things. But yes, he would go into houses to check them out. He was actually a security system person. He would go into people's homes and install their security systems. Mm-hmm. So he did know layouts. He did know how security systems worked. If he identified a potential victim doing that, he would know how to set it up so he could let himself in. So he did do a few where he then did not go back, but certainly had ideas about possibilities.
How did he talk about how he managed to balance home and murder life, if you will, you know, home and work life?
He has a great metaphor, actually.
Yeah.
You know, psychologists call this compartmentalization, which is a long word that isn't really as vivid as Rader's idea. He calls it cubing.
Okay.
And by that he means that they take a cube, and on each side is an identity. So Boy Scout, volunteer, good husband, serial killer, thief, good father, church president, things like that. So if you think of each of the size of the cube as being one of those identities, he could turn whatever side he needed, depending on the circumstances, and flip, you know, make quick pivots to another one if needed. So he could be a good neighbor, but then he spots one of his neighbors, which didn't happen, that he thought would make a good victim, and bang, turn it back around. He's the serial killer now. But turn that back around, he's the good father when his daughter gets scared that a woman in her neighborhood had been killed.
Yeah.
Right. So it's all the sides are one person, but they're not visible to him when he's got one side turned out. Right. So sure. I think that's a really interesting notion. He called them life frames, and that he can switch in and out of any given life frame depending on the circumstances. And that would only be achievable if you do not have any commitment to integrity or truth. And someone who's a narcissist, especially a psychopathic type of narcissist, doesn't. Their commitment is to themselves and to what they want. So they will use anything they need to get there. And if what they want is to live a supposedly normal life while also being able to kill, they'll develop their life to accommodate both.
Sure. Was there ever any time that he spoke of prior to his arrest for those many decades that he was concerned that maybe a family member may have been on to him or suspicious in any way, shape, or form of his activities?
He was afraid a couple of times that his wife, like once he was writing a postcard to, because he played this cat and mouse game with the media where he'd send things.
Sure, sure.
And once his wife caught him spelling something, she said, "You spell your words like that BTK guy." And he quickly covered and said, "Well, we probably went to the same schools with the same kinds of exercises and whatnot." Yeah, yeah. And there were a couple other things where, you know, but the thing is, let me just say on her behalf and on behalf of all families of these guys everywhere, no one is thinking the guy I live with is a serial killer, or my son or my daughter. They're not thinking that. They will see almost everything in the most benign possible way. So it's easy to say, well, okay, that makes sense. Or, well, you know, you were out last night and this murder happened. Oh, okay. You were at the library. Okay. That's typically what people will do.
Sure.
They will not immediately go, well, wait a minute, you were gone and a murder happened, so you must be the murderer. Because that would make them automatically unsafe to think that. So people noticed a couple of odd things that made him sweat, but nobody really thought too much about it. And I think that's what you're going to find in one case after another of those serial killers who have families and have jobs and have obligations, is it's very easy for people around them to not see how, you know, how evil they are, how duplicitous they are, how manipulative they are, because for the most part, we're not thinking that about other people.
Did he ever actively try to condition his family in one way, shape, or form to help hide who he was? That's something I've been wondering about a bit with the recent Rex Heuermann arrest. Makes me wonder how much was going on with this family that slowly, insidiously, he got them thinking one way to hide his tracks where otherwise they may look a little more evident.
Well, it's not just family, it's friends. It's
sure.
a coworker. I mean, that's what a person who's living a double life, and whether it's a serial killer or someone just having an affair.
Sure.
A person living a double life is actively deceiving people on a regular basis to keep them from being suspicious. And since Rader wasn't killing anywhere, except for in one instance, he wasn't killing where his family might say, well, wow, you knew that person, or you were last seen with that person. It wasn't anything like that. So why would they think anything?
There's more to come in my conversation with Dr. Kathryn Ramsland about the BTK killer, Dennis Rader. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our five-part series here on the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.